Hello and welcome to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Robert Johnson, a York Rite Mason and Knight Templar. Wow. Last week, I went camping with some friends. It was a nice getaway. When I returned home, I attended a third degree for a brother on Monday. The master of the lodge said to us all as we were leaving, "Get home safely." Well, that evening, on the way home, I got into a head-on collision. A car was driving into oncoming traffic and hit me. It was pretty amazing. It was my first car accident. It was not something I wished to repeat. Anyway, I got out of there without a scratch, except for a few sore bones. And because of this, this week's episode is a little bit shorter, and I apologize for that. I have a car to replace and lots of other things to sort out. I'd like to start this week off with a piece from the latest issue of the California Freemason. From California Freemasonry, the history section, entitled Into the Heart of the Craft, the evolution of ritual drama provides a glimpse into the inner workings of Masonry, by Heather Borner. A man enters, he is blindfolded, he steps into a room, but it's different than the way it usually looks, rearranged in a methodical manner before he arrived. It is both lodge room and Solomon's Temple. He is both a modern man, a banker, or a realtor, or teacher, and Hiram Abiff. His trusted brothers are no longer his brothers. They are Solomon, Hiram, King of Tyre, and most frighteningly, the ruffians. The mood is somber. Apprehension coils in his back. Despite knowing his fate, he steps toward it, determined to move from the profane and into the heart of the craft. "The purpose of ritual drama is to cause a change in a person," says Adam Kendall, collections manager at the Henry W. Coyle Library and Museum of Freemasonry. "When the candidate is in the right state of mind, you can feel the tenseness. He's not super coiled, but he is apprehensive. There is a laying on of hands. There is a transfer of energy. In the third degree, there is the use of touch and breath. This is part of the inner workings of ritual. That is how the mind becomes receptive, through fear and anticipation and energy. It's feeling all around, voices out of nowhere. This is how we learn. This is the heart of Masonry, ritual drama. Through the ritual, brothers are transported from present to past, from temporal to ineffable. As they work their way through the line, they learn every nuance of the story of Hiram Abiff and assimilate its meaning and lessons. Just as the ritual transforms men, so has the form of ritual evolved over the years. Up until the 1870s, Masons in the Blue Lodge conducted their degree work in business clothes, with Masonic aprons enough to transport them to another time and place. 20 years later, writes William D. Moore in the Masonic Temple's Freemasonry, Ritual Architecture, and Masculine Archetypes, Masons started using costumes in their ritual dramas. By the 1920s, scores of companies had popped up to cater to the need of Masonic regalia, props, and backdrops. What's more, circuses like Ringling Brothers, whose owners were all Masons, created elaborate circus pageants featuring characters in the Masonic ritual, but with added elephants, lions, and dancing girls. Meanwhile, the Scottish Rite moved from traditional lodge rooms to specially constructed theaters, employing more costumes and turning the initiate from participant in the ritual to an audience who received degrees en masse. How did ritual drama change so much in just a few decades? The answer lies as much in society's relationship to entertainment, theater, and gender as it does in the needs of the Brotherhood. Three threads of change. It's hard to imagine today, with the near constant access to television, music, radio, and email, but in the early 19th century, public entertainment was sparse, and theater a rare thing. Likewise, moralistic attributes, attitudes about theater meant Americans may not have visited theaters even if they had been available, suggests Kenneth L. Ames in The Lure of the Spectacular, in Theater of the Fraternity. But during the second half of the 19th century, he writes, theaters become local institutions and theatrical presentations, both amateur and professional, attracted large, eclectic audiences. At the time in the mid-19th century, spheres that had heretofore been male bastions were being infiltrated by women. The arts, the church, and the theater were all feminized to varying degrees, writes Ames. The Masonic ritual drama, however, stayed staunchly by men and for men, Ames claims. that the growth in the fraternal lodges was a reaction in part to the feminization of formerly male strongholds. To claim a part of the theater just for men, they turned to their ritual, he explains. But there was also one more thread that emerged at the time, modernization. The cultural obsession with the new was just materializing in the 19th century. The advent of trains, steamships, cars, telephones, radios, movies, central heating, indoor plumbing, all of this proclaimed that the future was in innovation. Masonic ritual, meanwhile, depended upon a form of melodrama that was becoming increasingly passé, claims Ames. What had seemed adequate or even impressive in the past began to appear second-rate and even unacceptable by the late 19th and 20th century, he writes. Although the ritual could not easily be changed without overhauling the entire structure of the fraternity, it could be packaged more effectively. Explosion of interest. That packaging then came in the form of costumes, lighting, and for the Scottish Rite, a move to the stage. The change had an immediate and overwhelming impact. For most of the 19th century, the Scottish Rite had 10,000 to 15,000 members. By 1927, says Mary Ann Clausen, Ph.D., in her article in the journal Haredom, membership grew to nearly 600,000. Brothers began expressing their love of ritual drama in theatrical terms. Edwin Booth, a 19th century Masonic actor, compared ritual drama to Shakespeare, explaining, "I have never and nowhere met tragedy so real, so sublime, so magnificent as the legend of Hiram. To be a worshipful master and to throw my whole soul into that work with a candidate for my audience and the lodge for my stage would be a greater personal distinction than to receive the plaudits of people in the theaters of the world." Back to the words. Still, the core of the ritual drama is the story and the lessons it teaches, told in poetic language of the 19th century, says Kendall. "Any ritual like this is psychodrama that transforms the candidate," he says. "Craft Lodge is personal experience, a localized drama. You cannot take back what you give to that man. If it's not handled with care, it can affect his entire experience."
Freemason conspiracies.
These days, most people have heard of Microsoft Corporation and its founder, Bill Gates. The majority of computers in use today use Microsoft System software, and those that do not often run applications from Microsoft. However, few people know the true story behind the rise of Microsoft, and even fewer suspect the terrible cosmic secrets that are concealed beneath the facade of a successful software company. Few people for sure know how many buildings there are in the Microsoft campus in Redmond, Washington. No maps of the entire facility are known to exist. Some Microsoft employees put the estimate at 6 or 3. An article in an Australian newspaper has claimed that there are 22 buildings. That is partly true, however, there is another building hidden from the public and even from most Microsoft employees. The 23rd building, or Building 7, is a pentagonal in shape. Its exact location is known only to 5 people, of whom Bill Gates may be one. However, it is believed that the building is accessible from elsewhere in the Microsoft campus by a secret passage. What is in the 5-sided building is not known. However, it is believed that the contents of Building 7 are of a supernatural nature. Apart from the Pentagon, there was a similar 5-sided building in Nazi Germany. This has been carefully kept hidden from the public. One hypothesis is that Building 7 is inhabited by, or used to communicate with, the inner head, or controlling unknown. The identity of the outer head is unknown. Bill Gates may be the outer head, a high initiate of the conspiracy, or just a figurehead whose purpose it is to divert attention. It has been already speculated that the name of the founder, Bill Gates, is a code, much as Adam Weishaupt was a code, apart from being the name of a magician in Aleister Crowley's novel Moonchild. Gates is reference to unknown superior and the gateway between ordinary reality and the invisible world. Lovecraft himself referred to Yog-Sothoth as the gateless gate. By the same token, IBM can be said to stand not for international business machines, but rather for Jacobus Burgundus Malensis, or Jacques de Molay, the last overt Grand Master of the Knights Templar, whose name was borrowed by the Bavarian Illuminati. and the Freemasons for one of their ciphers. One must also not forget that Microsoft Network Administration tool currently under development is named Hermes, after the god of alchemy, and that a line in Umberto Eco's novel, Foucault's Pendulum, reads quite clearly Microsoft Hermes. It is nothing more than a reminder of Cthulhu motto Novus Ordo Seclorum on the United States dollar bill. Does it refer to the secret numerical value of bill in Hebrew and Greek is 72, which is the number of division in Illuminati pyramid? Gates in Hebrew is 78, which is 13 times 6. Thus, Bill Gates is a description of the pyramid. 72 divisions, 13 levels, and 6 sides, including the flat top where the eye of the triangle sits. Wow. Well, that concludes this week's train wreck. We'll move on to this week's famous Freemason, Fiorello LaGuardia. Fiorello LaGuardia, born December 11, 1882, passed to the Grand Lodge on High on September 20, 1947. U.S. Congressman and Mayor of New York City, Fiorello Henry LaGuardia was born in New York City. He was with the American Consulate in Budapest, Hungary, Trieste, Austria, 1901 to 1904, and at Fiume, Hungary, 1904 to 1906. From 1907 to 1910, he was an interpreter at Ellis Island, New York. He began law practice in 1910 in New York City. A member of the 65th and 66th U.S. Congress, 1917 to 1919, and 68th 72nd Congress, 1923 to 33, LaGuardia served 3 terms as mayor of New York City, from 1934 to 1945. In 1946, he was special U.S. ambassador to Brazil and director general of the UNRRA the same year. In World War I, he was in the U.S. Air Service, achieving the rank of major. He commanded the 8th Center Aviation School and was attached to night and day bombing squadrons on the Italian front. As a congressman, LaGuardia championed greater immigration and removing U.S. troops from Nicaragua, supported the rights of the livelihoods of striking miners, impoverished farmers, oppressed minorities, and struggling families, and fought for progressive income taxes, greater government oversight of Wall Street, and national employment insurance for workers idled by the Great Depression. Historians have recognized LaGuardia as the greatest mayor in New York City history, and perhaps the greatest in the United States. Raised in 1913 as a life member, October 17, 1933, Garibaldi Lodge, number 542, New York City. That's it for this week. I hope you all enjoyed. As always, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Whence Came You. Check out the Midnight Freemasons website as well. You can find links to all that and more, including links to our app, which lets you listen via streaming, and you won't ever have to worry about syncing again, at our website, wcypodcast.blogspot.com. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.